had developed the atomic bomb, which they were very close to doing, they could use their V-2 rockets to annihilate all of Western Europe, which would have been in the range of their fire from from Germany, or at least from the Baltic coast. It was Wernher von Braun of Germany who developed those rockets, and after the war, we brought him to this country, and he headed our program in rocketry up until this last year. The development of those rockets, high-powered rockets, permitted first the communication satellites that revolve around the globe now, and we bounce our messages off those and reach almost any part of the world. Also, those rockets furnished the basis of the large-scale propellants in which we got to the moon, and even have sent vehicles way out as far as Venus, millions of miles away, and even taken pictures and sent them back through the airwaves or the ether waves, and where we it seems just incredible to me that a million miles out in space, with no more electric power probably than in an automobile battery, the ether can be enough disturbed and beamed toward the United States so we can actually pick up pictures of the surface of Venus. To sum up, up to the time I was born, human beings could have relatively little influence on the forces of nature. Through technology, we've found out in my lifetime how to break down the atom and how to study the composition of the whole universe. No doubt, in the next generation, there'll be tremendous discoveries too. But I sometimes question whether any other human beings will ever live to see the profound changes that I've witnessed in my lifetime. As I said, it's hard for me to see how anybody can be bored with the period that we live in. Here we are living in what would be just an instant in the eons that this planet has lived, and yet more than has happened to change life on this earth than in all that period before. That never ceases to excite me just to think of that privilege we've had of experiencing that change. Maybe the change isn't all for the better. I sometimes think that the very changes are going to do more damage from here on than provide gains. But up to this point, there's no question but what we've gone a long way to eliminate starvation in the world and take off the degrading manual labor of men's backs to live even on a subsistence scale of living in this world. When I was a boy, St. Paul, like all cities, was closely built. And of course, that was because of the transportation problem. Most factories, wholesale houses, and retail businesses were in the heart of the city because they had to be approached either walking, as most people did, to their place of work, or by public conveyance like horse cars or street cars. It is true that there were the beginning of suburbs. For example, the railroad line we called then the short line, which is the Milwaukee tracks going up and crossing Summit Avenue, had commuter trains running between St. Paul and Minneapolis. Every half hour, they stopped at Linwood Park, which was the foot of Victoria Street, and that little section up out around Lombard Street and St. Clair, where there's some old houses, were reached by people taking the train. Likewise, Merriam Park grew up when the railroad station, commuting station, was where the tracks crossed Pryor Avenue. And I remember very well the station standing right next to Pryor Avenue there. However, there was a long gap between where the city, as I remembered as a boy, stopped, the build-up part of it, and about Victoria Street, out to beyond Snelling Avenue, because there was no way to reach it unless you walked there from either Merriam Park or from Dale Street, where the cable car stopped. We used to go swimming in a pond we called Sandy, which was just south of Marshall Avenue, in between there and Selby Avenue, Dayton Avenue not being cut through, and just short of Lexington Avenue. We took some chances swimming there, because there were some quicksands in it, and when one of our schoolmates was drowned there, we no longer swam there. So we moved out and swam in a place that is farther out, about three or four blocks west of Lexington, between Marshall and Selby Avenue, where there was another pond. The only trouble there was it was pretty shallow and warm and was full of bloodsuckers. And after we came out, each one of us would have to lie down and let the others pick the bloodsuckers off of them. You'd often get 20 or 30 off. But they were little fellows, only an inch or so long, and they didn't hurt very much. Also, old Dr. O'Huggy bought what is now Harriet Island, I guess it was Harriet Island then, and gave it to the city. And the city built some bathhouses on the shore, just above where the yacht club is over there now. And it was a sandy bottom there, and it was used for bathing. I suppose there was raw sewage dumped into the river then in Minneapolis, because there was no sewage disposal system at that time. But the theory was that the river was supposed to purify itself in 10 miles. At any rate, we used to go down and swim there. You paid 5 cents, and they were given a towel and a little tiny piece of soap. And you had a little booth you could go in and change your clothes. We used to walk down there from where we lived in Marshall Avenue and either walk across the Wabashaw Street Bridge, or we would go down to the foot of Washington Street, where a fellow rode a little rowboat and took you across the river to Harriet Island for 5 cents. Coming home, we were going up Washington Avenue, we walked past the old red light district where the three big sporting houses, well-known sporting houses, were. And we used to see the girls in the windows all painted up, but we were too young. They didn't beckon to us to come in, and we weren't quite sure what the whole thing was about at that age of 10 or 11 years old. I mentioned suburban development to the west. There was also some to the south. Newport, Highwood, St. Paul Park were reached by the Burlington Motor, which was a two-car little passenger train running from the Union Depot down there, at least morning and evening when people came to and went from work. As for commuting on the west side, way back about 1910, Mr. Charles Stickney developed what is now the Dodge property on Delaware Avenue, and that was way out in the country. He drove to town with a fast team of horses, had a coachman take him in and come and get him every day. Horace Klein bought that place about 16 years before we built, 1928, which must have been about 1912. And for a year or two, he had a coachman drive into town with a fast team of horses. But then that changed when the automobile came in. To go back and catalog some of the great advances in technology in the last 5 years, one of the most noteworthy is in the medical sciences. It's only in the last 50 years that these great discoveries have been made, which have virtually eliminated a great many of the contagious diseases that had wrecked the world for centuries. Cholera, yellow fever, tuberculosis, scarlet fever, measles, diphtheria, gonorrhea, syphilis, malaria. They have been virtually conquered by the development of vaccines and other methods of treatment. It's true, gonorrhea and syphilis seem to be surging upward again in this country. But that's due to the greater sexual freedom of the youth particularly, and the fact that they're careless about it if they contract the disease, and not due to the fact that we don't know how to cure it. Of course, the conquest of these diseases has tremendously prolonged the average lifespan of the population and has eliminated a great deal of human suffering. However, one sometimes wonders whether in the long run we may have to pay the penalty. Perhaps nature knew best. When we have always had a very rapid birth rate in most countries, the population was held down primarily by disease, particularly diseases in early childhood, because a considerable number of children died before the age of 3 years. Did in my family, and as I look back over our genealogy, sometimes half of a brood of children would die before the age of five. Twice in the last 500 years, one-third of the population of Western Europe has been wiped out by the Black Death, which I guess was cholera. Starvation, as well as disease, played an important part in limiting the population of the world. Up to within 100 years, the population of the world, from what we know of it, grew very slowly. It isn't that the birth rate has expanded so much since, but that the lifespan has been expanded is causing this astronomic increase in population in the world. So instead of doubling over centuries, it's now going to double by the turn of the next century. A dramatic example of this tremendous increase in population that is going on this planet is the experience last year when at the mouth of the Ganges River in East Bengal, it was reported that about 400,000 people lost their lives in the floods in the delta of that river in a great storm that swept that part of the country. Now that seems a tremendous number of people, and yet the population on the subcontinent, that is India and Pakistan together, made up that population in 21 days. Another great technological advance we've experienced within the last 40 years is the development of mass production. It was Henry Ford who first developed the assembly line for automobiles, which has now been extended to a great many other manufactured processes. This has been accelerated too by the development of automation, so that a complete automobile engine can be developed in a plant almost to completion without any human hands touching it, but only men sitting and watching a switchboard and see that red lights don't flash. That means something has gone wrong. That, in turn, automation has been accelerated by the developer of the computer, as so many of these mechanical processes are controlled by the computer, not to mention the fact that a computer as an accounting mechanism has relieved tens of thousands of hundreds of thousands of clerical workers, where the work can be done faster and more accurately by computers. Even our children can remember the advent of the automatic telephone. AT&T a few years ago put out some figures that showed, with the tremendous increased use of the telephone, that if we still had to have the old manual operation where you called a switchboard operator to complete a call, there were not enough women in the age of between 16 and 24 in the United States to man those switchboards. In other words, anything that can be produced by machines and automatic production has remained relatively cheap. For example, we can produce a small automobile for around $2,000 and a motorcycle for just a few $100s. In contrast, where human labor is the large part of it, here's an example. Just a couple of weeks ago, our lake pump went out of order. The electrician came, took it up, took it to town, worked on it perhaps a day or two, brought it back, then had to take it back the second time, and the total bill was $272, or about an eighth what it would cost to build an automobile. That certainly dramatizes the difference between handwork and machine work. As I look back upon it, I had a very happy childhood. I know a lot of people who say they did not. I must have been very lucky. I never had any real disagreements with my parents. My father was a strong person, but he was shy and rather uncommunicative. I don't think in his lifetime he ever spent what he earned in a year. He never owed a cent of money. I don't even a mortgage on his home, to the best of my knowledge. My father wasn't much of a companion for me. He never played any outdoor games with me. He wasn't physically very strong. We never went camping together. But I can't ever remember him disciplining me. By the time I was 12 years old, my brother being 6 years older and then going to college, I expected to cut the grass, weed the garden, always take care of the furnace, as well as this pony I took care of, but there was never any difficulty. I never had to be driven to do those things. I expected to do it and didn't feel in the slightest abused. My mother was really a remarkable person. She had a broad range of interest. She was active in women's clubs like the Daughters of the Revolution, of which she was regent for a period, in the Thursday Club and those things. She did not move in the top social circles of St. Paul, the crowd who lived over on Summit Avenue, the high society of St. Paul in those days was in quite was almost entirely dominated by the old jobbing families, who ran the wholesale houses, which was the core of the business of St. Paul in those early days, and where Mother knew some of those women through club activities. Her friends were really friends in the neighborhood, and they had their little luncheons. The older people used to play croquet in those days, and I was sometimes drafted in the evening as it got dark to hold a light so that the acetylene lamp and shine it on the balls so they could see them to finish a very exciting game. I also sometimes had to make a smudge of smoke to keep the mosquitoes off, which would get pretty tough then, as we had no metropolitan mosquito control, and I can't remember we had any sprays or anything of that sort to eliminate mosquitoes. My mother did have a great influence on my early life, I'm sure. She was quite a companion to me in any way, and I admired her tremendously. She loved picnics and the outdoors. She loved travel, was very observant of nature. Having railroad passes, she and Father did travel a good deal, and very late in life, they took a trip to Europe by steamship each way, and she didn't miss a thing the whole way. She also kept a diary for many years, in which I have a copy, and that still brings out her tremendous interest in what was going on in the world. I said we had a very happy childhood, and we did. This generation, a number of my grandchildren, perhaps the majority of them, think they have to be amused by playing records, by the radio, by television, by riding a motorcycle, or something of that sort. We had none of those things when I was young, and I can't ever remember being bored, nor I don't remember other kids being bored. We made our own fun. When we were very young, we played hide-and-go-seek and run sheep run. I had a bulldog, bull terrier, that used to sleep in the bed with me, Teddy. I used to hitch him up with a little harness my mother made to a sled and drive him around the neighborhood in winter. Once drove him all the way out to the river drive and back and had a winter picnic by the shore of the river. We also, I mentioned the pony before. In those days, the fire departments had horses to pull the fire engines and hook and ladders, and the horses were in these stalls that when the fire alarm came, the door would open and the horses would run out and the firemen would slide down the brass pole from the second floor and clap the harnesses on these horses as they were trained to stand in front of the vehicles, and it was a great excitement. So we had to do that with the pony. So this Ed Barrow and I spent literally weeks training this little pony of mine to rush out of the her stall and stand in front of the buggy where we had a harness that we had a kind of a make-believe automatic thing. We could pull a handle and the harness would drop down on its back and we'd buckle it up. Well, that was great fun and took a lot of time. We had a little telephone line with a single wire run by batteries running down to the Grosche and Vork's house about a block away. Incidentally, our son John did the same thing out at the lake here, and he was never bored here in the country. He always find things to do, to dig a cave, build a tree house, and that sort of thing. Duncan wasn't quite as good at entertaining himself. But at least he was in the St. Paul Academy, and they kept them very busy afternoons at that time. So and studying in the evening, he didn't have too much time to get bored, and he went off to boys' camps or one thing or another in the summer. But there is a vast difference now with children expecting somebody or something to entertain them, instead of having the much more rewarding job of creating your own entertainment. It's interesting that bicycles are now coming in back into vogue. There was quite a rage of bicycles when I was young. As I remember it, very few people rode them to work, and I never knew a boy to ride them to school. We did use them for recreation. Father and mother each had a bicycle, and my brother and I had smaller ones, and often on Sundays we would take a long ride. There was a cycle path down that parkway in the middle of Summit Avenue, all the way from Lexington out to the River Drive, then along back of the country club up about as far as the Franklin Bridge over the Mississippi. Also a cycle path across Cleveland from Summit out to Fort Snelling, and from Fort Snelling over to Minnehaha Falls. Some adventurous older boys would ride as far as White Bear or Minnetonka on the sandy roads. Our family didn't do that, but I say we often rode off on these Sunday picnics. In summer, we usually went off for a vacation for 3 or 4 weeks, mother taking both of us boys, or later me, and father joining us for a couple of weeks. We spent a couple of summers at the Doll House at Chisago. Later, I earlier mentioned the summers we spent on the farm up near Chisago City. We went out to Maple Lake when I was perhaps 12 years old and stayed on a farm there. At that same time, the Hubert and Walter Kennedy were there with their mother and the Hill girls. Eleanor Hill later married Kincaid, and just the other day she and I were kidding. She was the first girl I ever kissed. We were playing post office there at this farm at Maple Lake, and when you won a certain thing, or you had the privilege of kissing a girl, it was a very modest peck and no petting, I can assure you. I can't remember all through high school days a single case of petting. When you left a girl, if you took her home from a dance or something, you never expect to put your arm around her or kiss her at the door. It just wasn't done and wasn't expected. I had a terrible crush about my junior year on a girl that lived down the block named Frances Seddon. She didn't think very much of me. She had another boy she'd boat around with, which almost broke my heart, but I really pined for her a few months. But most of my high school years, I played around with and took to dances a variety of girls, a girl named Hope Young and a girl named Leslie. I remember particularly I took around. We had lots of fun in high school. There was a little crowd of maybe 20 of us that more or less ran the social life of the school. We ran the school paper, we took part in the plays and operettas. We had a dancing class and later a club that met at a little hall out on Pryor Avenue. We always went out, of course, on the streetcar and had always a chaperone. There was dancing in those days and parties were not as barbaric as they became later, where you had cut-in dances. We always had program dances. And we did even when I went through college. Therefore, if you went to a dance, you always expect the girl you took would be dated up on her program, and you would make out a program for her to see that she danced every dance. So you didn't have the girls that were left out and sat on the sidelines and then went home sobbing, which I saw in later life when our children were young. I said there was no petting at that time, and there really wasn't. I think there were about 2,000 boys and girls at the old Central High School, which was downtown, where the police station now is on Minnesota and 10th Street. It was a terrible old fire trap, really 4 stories high, wood interior construction, open stairways, and it's just a marvel that it didn't burn down. But we didn't think it was, we suffered anything from it. There was nothing like a lunchroom if you stayed down in the afternoon to take part or rehearse in some play or something of that sort. You went over to a dirty little store